From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Ari Snyder with the news on this day in Maine, Thursday, April 24th, 2025. The American Civil Liberties Union of Maine says the Trump administration has arbitrarily revoked the visa of an international graduate student at Northeastern University's Rue Institute in Portland. ACLU attorney Zach Hyden says the student, who asked not to be named due to the sensitivity of their case, is among dozens of international students across New England whose lives have been suddenly disrupted.
They're not able to continue with their studies. They can't continue doing work. They have to live in fear that they might be deported, all for doing nothing wrong.
The ACLU last week joined a class action lawsuit on behalf of those students. The group says the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has terminated visas or legal status for more than 1,400 international students across the country. Northeastern University says as of last week, more than 40 of its students and recent graduates have had their visas revoked. Maine is among a dozen states suing the Trump administration over its tariff policy. The suit argues that President Trump overstepped his authority by imposing import taxes through executive orders, social media posts, and agency orders. Court documents filed Wednesday say Trump's actions reflect a national trade policy based on, quote, the president's whims, rather than the sound exercise of lawful authority. The coalition is asking the United States Court of International Trade to halt the tariffs and prevent the administration from enforcing or implementing them. Earlier this month, Trump abruptly announced a 90-day pause on most tariffs after markets nosedived across the globe. A Democrat from Bristol is the latest person to announce plans to challenge Republican Senator Susan Collins next year. Jordan Wood grew up in Lewiston but spent about a decade working in Washington, D.C. for national political groups and a Democratic congresswoman from California. On Wednesday, Wood filed his candidacy paperwork. He also released a campaign video criticizing Collins, the Trump administration, Republicans, and some Democrats.
I'm running for U.S. Senate to take our country back from the rich and the well-connected, the extremists, and the cowards who let it happen.
Maine's Senate race is expected to be one of the most competitive in the country. Four people have filed papers to challenge Susan Collins to date, but the number of candidates is expected to grow considerably heading into next year. The Maine Department of Education will not sign a letter confirming with the federal government that it has removed diversity, equity, and inclusion programs from schools. Maddie Smith has more.
The decision follows an April 3rd notice from the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. It directed states to remove DEI programming to comply with Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, or lose federal funding. On Thursday, the Maine Department of Education sent a letter to the Office of Civil Rights stating that it does comply with Title VI, but after consultation with the Maine Attorney General, determined that, quote, signing the new certification would bind the Maine DOE to language of executive orders or other federal guidance without the force of law. The notice states that the Maine DOE will not sign the April 3rd certification and asks that local school districts not sign it either. A federal judge in New Hampshire ruled Thursday that the Trump administration cannot cut federal funding to schools with DEI programs. The ruling came in a lawsuit brought by the American Civil Liberties Union and others that argued that the guidance was vague and hard to follow. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Maddie Smith.
A legislative committee heard testimony today on a bipartisan bill to provide resources to farmers affected by federal funding cuts. The bill presented by Senator Stacey Brenner, a Democrat from Gorham, would modify the Agricultural Marketing Loan Fund to provide funding in the event of lost federal grants or loans or to recover in the event of a disaster.
We're not creating a new bureaucracy. We're strengthening a trusted tool, giving farmers access to low-interest state-backed loans when they need them most to recover, to rebuild, and to continue to feed our communities.
Brenner says there is money currently available in the fund, and redefining what it can be used for will put less stress on the general fund for agriculture. South Portland is Maine's largest oil port, with more than 100 tanks and millions of barrels of crude oil and other petroleum products shipped in and out through terminals along the Four River. Over the years, residents have raised concerns about air quality and public health issues they attribute to the tanks. And now, state lawmakers are considering a bill that supporters say would require public warnings be issued when pollutants are at higher levels. Molly Anking reports.
From Bob Klotz's front garden, you can't see any of the South Portland oil tanks. But on certain days, he says, he can smell them, especially on his morning walks.
We tend to do the big wide loop that takes you down to Four River, so the global tank is right there. And then you walk towards the left. And the other tanks you can see, and you can see them unloading tankers there.
Klotz, an environmental activist and retired physician's assistant, lives near two tank farms. He says the odor from the tanks has become all too familiar.
It's got a density and an edge to it, and it feels dark and icky and dirty. And so to smell that and know that I'm breathing it in and to be unsure how it's affecting me is troubling.
For years, Klotz and other residents raised concerns about air quality. That came to a head back in 2019 when the Federal Environmental Protection Agency sued Sprague and Global, two of the oil terminal companies, for violations to the Clean Air Act. Since then, the Maine Department of Environmental Protection has installed air monitors around the city. And, following legislation in 2023, the marine terminal operators have placed monitors along the fence lines that enclose the tank yards. Those have been online for less than a year. The Maine CDC is still working on a comprehensive study of the last 5 years of data, which is expected in the coming months. But some residents say that's not enough.
The odor is overwhelming at times, but the real question is, what are the tanks emitting? What are residents inhaling? And how is it impacting our health?
State Senator Ann Carney of South Portland has joined forces with her House colleague Matthew Beck, who is sponsoring legislation that would require the terminal companies to issue public alerts when vapors might be released from the tanks.
This notice would give members of the public the opportunity to plan their day so they may be able to leave the immediate vicinity during oil transfers or at least close their windows to minimize their potential exposure to any hazardous vapors that may be released.
The hazardous vapors in this case are VOCs, or volatile organic compounds, which can irritate the eyes, nose, and throat and cause headaches, respiratory problems, and even cancer with prolonged exposure. Of particular concern to residents are emissions that occur at specific times, when petroleum products are being loaded and unloaded from the storage tanks.
A high episodic release is probably as dangerous or maybe even more dangerous than a small, continuous release over long periods of time.
David Carpenter is a professor of environmental health at the University of Albany who has studied air pollution issues. Carpenter says when an oil tank is being filled, the existing vapors inside are displaced by the liquid, and during offloading, the liquid itself is being agitated, which can lead to the release of VOCs. Carpenter says these emissions can be a blind spot in air quality regulations.
A release that doesn't last for a whole week, but lasts for maybe 30 minutes at an extremely high level is extraordinarily dangerous, and it's not captured by most of our federal standards.
The terminal operators have so far resisted calls to issue air quality warnings voluntarily, citing security concerns. At a public hearing on the bill, Tim Winters, VP of Operations at Sprague, says the strong odors aren't necessarily VOCs.
We all remember from chemistry that a few molecules of a compound open up in chemistry class will create an odor that permeates the room, but there's no harm to us as students.
Nick Scally, a Sprague representative, couldn't comment on the ongoing discussions with the city when reached directly, but says the companies already report their shipping schedule to the local fire department.
There's a lot of reporting that happens currently. I think the concern there was like you're going to start scaring your citizens unnecessarily, and it isn't even always correlated to the concerns that you think you might have.
With South Portland so densely populated, Senator Carney says, residents want to know for certain that their air is safe, especially given how close some of the tank farms are to schools.
Kaler Elementary School is very close to an oil tank. If you stand on the playground and you're a third grader, you can probably throw a tennis ball and hit or come close to hitting the tank.
If the bill is passed, the operators would be required to begin issuing notices in mid-2026.
This we've had to trim back because it's a big raspberry bush that our neighbors are allowed to participate in. The raised bed back over there is really pretty dedicated to garlic.
Bob Klotz says the uncertainty affects his day-to-day life, from morning exercise to time spent in the garden. He says he's quite strict about organic growing practices in his yard.
But if that toxic stuff is landing on this, how organic is it really? And someone could say, well, everywhere that would be a risk, but I'm just concerned that it's a greater risk given this community's realities.
After over a decade in this house, Klotz and his partner are thinking about moving away from the oil tanks out of South Portland. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Molly Enking.
Developers are pitching the city of Portland on a new music venue, which they say will draw crowds of more than 3,000 people and attract more national touring artists. The Portland Music Hall would be owned and operated by Live Nation, which also owns Ticketmaster. But as Nicola Grisco reports, Portland's independent music and arts operators are fearful that the world's largest concert promotion company will change the city's character.
IDs if you're having alcohol.
Despite the rain, a few dozen people have lined up a few hours early outside the State Theater in downtown Portland. They're all vying for a prime spot to see the indie rock band Bright Eyes. Gwyneth Esty Kendall made the trip from Bangor for the show. She says she comes to Portland frequently for live music and wouldn't mind if the plans to build a mid-sized music venue about a half mile down Congress Street pans out.
More shows, the better. I feel like this has been a really good space, and I love the State Theater for the really intimate space that it provides, but I think having other bigger theaters for bigger shows would be great, too.
Live Nation says the proposed venue, with a capacity for about 3,300 people, would fill what some see as a gap in Southern Maine's live music scene. The Portland Music Hall would attract artists who are too big for the State Theater and Merrill Auditorium, which can both accommodate roughly 1,900 people, or too small for the Cross Insurance Arena, where concerts vary in size but can hold up to 9,000 people.
Our experience told us that clearly Portland was underserved. There was a hole in the market for a venue this size.
Don Law is the chairman of Live Nation New England, which wants to develop the new venue. He says other cities have seen success with similarly sized venues, including Allentown, Pennsylvania, and Boston, where Live Nation opened the MGM Music Hall at Fenway 3 years ago.
Every time this has happened, the market expands. More artists come. It stimulates the economy generally, and it has always been positive.
Law says the new venue would host 125 events a year and give Portland restaurants and businesses a boost, especially during weeknights and the off-season. And he says the project is meant to complement Portland's existing venues, not compete with them. Local performing arts groups and venue operators, though, disagree. Amy Petrin runs Portland Ovations. The nonprofit hosts performances at Merrill Auditorium, which is across the street from the proposed Portland Music Hall.
We all live and die on the tickets we sell in Portland. These nonprofits and local independently owned and operated venues all live and die on what happens here in Portland and reinvest that money back into Portland. This venue does not need our money. It won't leave the money locally. It will take the money out with it.
Live Nation brings in more than $32 billion in revenue each year. It owns, operates, and has exclusive booking rights for nearly 400 venues around the world. And last year, it was sued by the Justice Department and attorneys general from 40 states, who accused Live Nation and its subsidiary Ticketmaster of monopolizing the concert industry, from artist promotion and touring deals to ticketing and merchandise. But Don Law says he doesn't believe there will be much overlap between venues. He says the Portland Music Hall won't have Broadway or symphony performances.
There's no reason why many of these smaller venues shouldn't thrive as well. It creates a more vibrant music scene. Artists can work their way up. You're talking about a stepping stone. You know, we are very much like baseball, you know, where you have a farm system that they work their way up.
But local arts groups and venue operators say they worry that smaller venues will have a tough time staying in business. Lauren Wayne runs the State Theater.
The only competition I'm afraid of is the competition who's afraid of competition and then puts other competition out of business. And I think that's what we're talking about.
Wayne says as Live Nation builds or acquires more venues across the country, it'll be able to entice artists to skip independent rooms and tour exclusively at Live Nation spaces. That practice is documented in the Justice Department's antitrust lawsuit. There are also concerns about traffic and congestion downtown. Petrin says it's already a struggle to find parking for sold-out Portland Ovation shows at Merrill. It's worse, she says, when there are multiple events at venues around the city on the same night.
We literally have patrons who will email us or call us the day after a performance and say, we couldn't find parking, we turned around and went home. That's now.
There's no requirement for the music hall developers to have parking on site. Live Nation says in response to concerns, it has an agreement, though, to offer $20 event parking at two garages in Portland. Portland's existing venue operators, though, say they're concerned that added congestion will deter local residents from visiting smaller performing spaces, which feature local and independent artists. They are the lifeblood of Portland, says Lauren Wayne with the State Theater. And she believes with a multi-billion dollar corporation at the helm, the Music Hall project could change the character of the city that she moved to 25 years ago.
It was so local and fiercely independent. I've never, ever lived anywhere like it. And, you know, it's changed drastically since then, and that's fine. Growth is good. Smart growth is good. But, I mean, why do tourists come to Portland? They don't come for Walmart. They come for the restaurants. They come for the music. They come because we're on the ocean. They come because it's different.
On Monday, the Portland City Council is expected to vote on a temporary moratorium, which would pause the venue's development for 6 months, while city officials study the impacts on parking, congestion, and city infrastructure. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Nicole Ogrisco.
A Dover Foxcroft soldier who died in World War II will return to Maine to be buried after his remains were identified last fall. Caitlin Badion has more.
U.S. Army Private Willard D. Merrill was a member of the 2nd Observation Squadron when Japanese forces invaded the Philippine Islands in December of 1941, according to the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency. Merrill was among thousands of U.S. and Filipino service members who were captured after forces surrendered in the spring of 1942. They were subjected to the infamous 65-mile Bataan Death March and were held as prisoners of war. At the camp where Merrill was held, more than 2,500 prisoners died and were buried in the camp cemetery, including Merrill. After the war, the American Graves Registration Service exhumed the remains and relocated them to a temporary U.S. military mausoleum near Manila. But for decades, Merrill was among those not identified. Then, in 2019, the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency exhumed the remains for analysis, leading to Merrill's identification last year. His family received a full briefing on his identification, and he will be buried in Dover Foxcroft in June. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Caitlin Badion.
A Buxton woman who brought a medical malpractice wrongful death lawsuit against the federal government for her husband's death has been awarded $1.3 million by a federal judge. Roy Palmer was complaining of abdominal pain when his wife, Janet, dropped him off at the Togus VA Medical Hospital in Augusta in April of 2020. Palmer, who is 69 years old and a U.S. Army veteran, was prescribed high doses of pain medication along with a sedative that led to his cardiac arrest and brain damage. The government later admitted that it was negligent in his care and treatment. Palmer was transferred to Maine Medical Center, where he slipped in and out of consciousness, able to respond to commands but unable to verbally communicate. He died 3 weeks after being first admitted to Togus. Because COVID restrictions were in place, his wife was only able to visit him once, and he spent the rest of the time in isolation. After careful consideration, U.S. District Judge Stacey Newman said she would award $175,000 for Roy Palmer's conscious pain, suffering, and mental anguish. She awarded $450,000 for economic losses and $750,000 for Janet Palmer's loss of companionship. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Coming up on Maine Calling at 11 tomorrow morning, Arbor Day and Tree Care. I'm Ari Snyder. Thanks for listening.